Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what were three Jewish political movements that were active in pre-World War II Eastern Europe? Dr. David Silberklang is senior historian at the International Institute for Holocaust Research at Yad Vashem and editor of the scholarly journal Yad Vashem Studies. He teaches Jewish history at the University of Haifa's Weiss-Livnat International MA program in Holocaust Studies and at the Rothberg International School of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He was also part of Israel's delegation to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance for 12 years as a member and chair of the Academic Working Group, a member of the Committee on Anti-Semitism and Holocaust Denial, and numerous other steering committees and planning teams. Among his past functions at Yad Vashem, Dr. Silberklang was editor-in-chief of publications, series editor of the Holocaust Survivors Memoirs Project, and chief historian of the Museum Development Project. In the last capacity, he wrote the extensive conceptual historical outline that served as the basis for the content of the Holocaust History Museum at Yad Vashem. In this program, Dr. Silberklang is speaking with us about the historical implications of the Holocaust. Thank you very much for speaking with us today. First, without going into too much detail, I wanted to ask you a couple of things about your own work. First, you were part of Israel's delegation to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. Can you speak a little bit about that? What is it?
The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance is an international organization of states, and there are now, I've lost track, but I think we're at 33 member states. And it's states that join, governments that make a decision. And in joining this organization, they commit themselves, these governments, to devoting government resources to Holocaust commemoration and remembrance, Holocaust education, and Holocaust research. And it began at the initiative of the Swedish Prime Minister, Göran Persson, in the late 1990s, just over 20 years ago. And grew from four countries that were members initially to where it is now. They do a great deal in trying to promote Holocaust education and research, paying attention to the Holocaust in countries, especially in Europe, but all over the world. Their goal is to reach all over the world. Most of the members are European. And they've gradually begun to have an impact, not only in each member country, but beyond. And one illustration of that is the working definition on anti-Semitism, which IRA, this organization, passed unanimously. The government representatives who sit there, not the historians and educators and so on, are the ones who make these decisions. And those government representatives voted unanimously in favor of this working definition. Working definition means that it's not a law, but rather a framework for reference so that we can, in our countries all over the world, have some idea of, you know, when we're looking around it, is this anti-Semitic or not? Whatever we heard or saw, how do we define it, and what are we teaching about when we teach about it? And that's made quite a splash ever since.
Is Spain a member?
Spain is a member. Spain joined, I don't remember exactly, but around 8-10 years ago. And Spain actually sends a serious delegation. I mean, I haven't been a member of this now for a year and a half, but certainly when I was a member, Spain would send a serious delegation, meaning that they had themselves represented in every major committee and subcommittee. They made sure that they had enough people, and the people were the appropriate people. A professor who teaches Holocaust University here sits on the academic working group, the academic committee, and the anti-Semitism committee, and another one who teaches education, Holocaust education, sits on the education committee, and so on. And so they're actually quite actively involved.
Do you work with other organizations?
IRA is kind of an umbrella. So I referred to the government representatives who were either diplomats or people out of ministries, from the foreign ministry or education ministry. But the actual hands-on preparation of work that those people are involved in and need to approve or not approve is done by experts. And those experts come from organizations with whom IRA interacts all the time. Some of them are obvious: Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, Auschwitz Memorial, and some other such places. Some of them are less known because we don't know all the memorial sites and the different professors or educators who deal with the subject in every country. And one of the interesting things for me personally there was encountering people from countries I hadn't really thought about. What do they do in connection to the Holocaust, and meeting the people who actually are seriously engaged in the subject in one capacity or another. So these are the experts who are doing the brass tacks work. And so IRA works with all these organizations all the time.
You also wrote the historical outline that served as the basis for the content of the Holocaust History Museum at Yad Vashem. This was a while ago. Can you tell us a little bit about that museum?
Yad Vashem's Holocaust History Museum, it's our new museum, but it's already 14 and a half years old, so it's not that new anymore. But we started working on it in the early 90s, and conceptually. And I joined the team in the mid-90s, in 1994, in framing the concept. And the museum, first of all, it was designed to be large enough to deal with the tourism coming to Israel and to Yad Vashem, so it had to just be bigger than what we had before that. But conceptually, we brought it forward to reflect questions and issues that researchers and people in the general public have been addressing in the 90s and the early 2000s, and ways that people approach the subject. For example, one thing you find when you walk through the museum is, of course, it's chronological in its basic outline and thematic, which is what many history museums will do, and museums of the Holocaust. The Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington is also chronological and thematic, which is logical, because you need to have some kind of a framework. But along the way with that, we try to highlight or spotlight individuals in the story or small groups of people, and we try to create this kind of zoom in and zoom out effect for the story, so that we don't only talk about in this place so-and-so many people lived and so many were deported in mass numbers, but look at those individuals, tell something of their story in the way a museum can do that, which is very brief, but say something about them, and then put that in the context of the larger picture. Another thing that we try very hard to do is our mandate at Yad Vashem is to tell the story of the Jews in the Holocaust, and that's what's written in the law. But to tell the story of the Jews, you have to also talk about, obviously, the Nazis and everyone else. And in conceiving the museum, we said, how do we approach this? And the decision was that, roughly, we're going to devote the overwhelming majority of the space of the museum that is dedicated to the actual history of the event, not the post-war, because we talk about survivors and all that as well. But up until that point, we will devote the large majority of the space to Jews and Nazis and others who are helping them, which is mainly the Germans. And that will, the space will be divided equally between the two. So to tell the Jewish story, we need that framework that the Germans created. I mean, they determined that what would happen, that they'll pass laws on this and this day, or that they'll deport people on that and that day, and so on. But we look at Jews as actors in the subject who have an impact on what's happening. They're part of the players in history. And that's another important element. So we try in the individualization to engage the visitor, and through that also to make sure that we relate to the Jews, and by the way, everyone involved in the subject, as human beings who are actors and making decisions or and facing dilemmas, especially Jews, in what to do, and relate to them as such, kind of looking them straight in the eye.
The topic of your talk was historical implications of the Holocaust. That's a very big topic.
Yes.
How did you approach it?
Well, historical implications, first of all, I try to lay out what do I mean by historical implications, and I strike a contrast between implications that people might draw from the event, but based upon the actual facts of the event, even if I disagree with how they interpret it or what implications or importance they see in the event. So I open with illustrations of things that we might not even agree with, but point to them as legitimate from a historian's point of view because they're grounded in the actual facts of the event. And I contrast that with something that would be illegitimate to even discuss in the context of what I'm talking about, which is denial of the Holocaust.
Can you give us a couple of examples?
Of the different approaches, yeah. For example, in the talk at the Jewish Community Center, I opened with how two ultra-Orthodox rabbis, both of whom were in the Holocaust, one survived, one did not, both of whom were from the Hungarian ultra-Orthodox rabbinic tradition. One, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe, and the other is Rabbi Shlomo Yisachar Teichtal, who was trained in Slovakia and lived in Budapest during the war. But they came from the same kind of circles, which is ultra-Orthodox in practice, very strict in the practice and interpretations of Jewish life, and anti-Zionist in the pre-war world, vehemently anti-Zionist. And Teichtal, who survived by being put on the what's known as the Kastner train, this train of Jews that was from all walks of Hungarian Jewish life that was let out through negotiations between some Jewish leaders and local Nazis, and 1,684 Jews reached Switzerland in 1944 and survived. Teitelbaum was on that, but his conclusion from the Holocaust was God's punishment for the Jews' sins. What sin? The sin of Zionism. And God had extracted a promise from the Jews at the destruction of the Second Temple and the exile then, saying that he will keep an eye on the Jews, but they will not live so well. They might suffer persecution, but only to a limited degree. And they promise that they will not try to climb the walls of Jerusalem symbolically, in order to recreate their own country until God sends the Mashiach, Messiah. That's their thinking. Along came the Zionists at Teitelbaum, and they broke the promise, so God punished us. Teichtal began in the same world. But as he thought through all this, and he published a book saying this, a very large theological treatise in rabbinic Hebrew that he published in December 1943, just a few months before he was sent to Auschwitz, where he was killed. It's called Eim HaBanim Smecha, and there he said, God is punishing the Jewish people for the sin of anti-Zionism. He's punishing the Jewish people because the Jewish leaders, meaning the rabbis, prevented the Jews from hearing the call. And he uses this allegory of God as the shepherd. And when a shepherd calls his flock, he rings the bell when he wants them to come and go wherever he wants them to go. And if they don't come, he rings again, he'll ring again, he'll ring again. If they don't come, he'll use the stick. Say, God brought us, rang the bell. The Zionist movement came. And we could have influenced it. It could be a religious Zionist movement that will be wonderful and bring the Jews out of exile. And he kept ringing the bell and we didn't go. And we the rabbis, prevented the Jews from going. So God is punishing us. Now, when I talk about that, I said both of these are, from a historian's point of view, they're theological ideas, but they're grounded in historical fact. Nazi Germany came along and murdered 6 million Jews along with their partners. And where it happened, how it happened, all those details are clear and no one doubts anything. Where is this coming from? And they both look to God's intervention in history. Many of us will look at that and say, how can you say God punished the Jews? What kind of punishment? And argue with them theologically. But historically, that's two legitimate approaches. What's not legitimate is if someone comes along and says, this never happened. It's some Jewish invention, Zionist invention, communist invention, whatever invention. Then maybe that's an interesting political position, but it's certainly got nothing to do with history.
So what are the historical implications and present-day implications?
Well, in my talk, I related to two planes of implications, particular issues that arise that the Holocaust kind of puts a spotlight on for Jews, and universal issues that the Holocaust spotlights, raises for all humanity, Jews, not Jews, everybody, people whose nations had some connection to the Holocaust in one way or another, and those who didn't, because there are questions about humanity and about our civilizations and so on. In the particular plane regarding Jews, I pointed to issues of faith, where was God, that arise, where I also tried to point out that, you know, this we should be a little humble, those who were not there, when a survivor has a question or an answer about that has something to do with God. You know, I doubt God's existence, I deny God's existence, or God save me, I'm alive because God intervened on my behalf, or anything else that they have to say, they're coming from somewhere that none of us even has an idea what it is to experience that. The rest of us, though, doesn't mean we don't have questions, and they're legitimate questions. And we might look back in history, as some Jews do, and see this long litany of persecution of Jews over time. And why the Jews? Why always the Jews? I don't think that that's a good interpretation of Jewish history, but certainly there was lots of persecution. So that's part of it. But one of the issues I raised was about Jewish demography. The Jews are the only people in World War II who never replenished their losses. Every people involved in World War II replenished their numerical losses. You can't replace someone who was killed, obviously. There's no replacement. But in terms of the people, how viable is the people as a nation? Every people involved is far more members of their nation now, or their ethnic group, than before World War II, except the Jews. The Jews before the war, according to the demographers' estimates, were 16, 17 million, and the most optimistic and generous estimates of Jews today talk about maybe 14 million. And that also depends on who you call a Jew, of course. You know, Jews like to argue about that too. So that's already like a gouge out of the side of the Jewish people. In addition to that, though, there was this massive cultural impact on the Jewish people. One of the major centers of gravity for the Jewish people was in Eastern Europe, grounded in Yiddish culture and in political activism, Jewish political activism. The Zionists, the Orthodox, fighting for politically for Orthodox positions, the Bund and other socialists of different kinds, and they were emerging out of Jewish life in their various political positions. And, of course, Yiddish culture. Before World War II, there were a few hundred Yiddish theaters in the world. Today, I'm aware of one that actually constantly is putting on Yiddish shows. It's staggering. Dino, Judeo-Espanol, yeah, there's still people who speak the language, of course, and read the language, but as an active cultural language, it was nearly wiped out by the Nazis, not to mention other languages and cultures that we don't even think about, Judeo-Tajik and all sorts of others that we know less about. So this impact on the Jewish people, I'm just giving one illustration there of the language, is enormous and ongoing, and we're still grappling with all of that. And one of the other particular issues I pointed to was in the post-war world, the Zionization of the Jewish world. Not that everybody became a Zionist, but everybody supported the idea, almost everybody supported the idea of the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. Even the Agudat Yisrael political party, the International Agudat Yisrael, which were not Zionist and still aren't Zionist, went and testified before the UN committees on the absolute need to create a Jewish state. And that was reflecting both their own conclusions from the war. It's dangerous in this world to be a Jew, and certainly those Jews who went through what they went through have nowhere to go home. They have to go somewhere, and home for a Jew is only one place right now, and that's going to the land of Israel. But they also were reflecting what Jews in the displaced persons camps were saying. They were being surveyed in like public opinion surveys. If you can go anywhere, where do you want to go? And 90% or more consistently were saying land of Israel. Kind of saying, we've had enough of all of you out there. We know what you're all about. We want to go somewhere where we're among ourselves and we feel safe. We'll argue with each other instead of being killed by you. And you know that's an important element, but I tried to point out also that we shouldn't carry that too far. A brief comment on the universal. I related to three different aspects of universal implications. There are many. I'm only kind of cherry-picking a few. One is issues regarding murderers and the questions that raises. I mean, there's research that points to what Germans and Austrians did isn't something that somehow Germans and Austrians are genetically or culturally programmed for. In a particular complex of circumstances and time and all that, people did what they did, but other people might be able under certain circumstances to do similar kinds of things. And that research, which is very disturbing, because who of us wants to think that we might be a potential murderer under certain circumstances? But that kind of research that's been going on now for 60 years is very important. It still hasn't given us all the answers by any means, but it's certainly shed light on the subject, a subject that is still disturbing humanity. I pointed to the failures of the major institutions we've created in modern civilization, failures of governments, failures of democracies, failures of liberal humanism, failures of education, failures of the churches, failures of all the things that we created as civilization that were meant to have order and peace in the world, mutual respect, tolerance coming out of humanism, and all of that was clearly not coming into play for most people during that period. And that's shakes up our modern civilization. So what are we all about? How do we fix this? In terms of bystanders, we relate to these issues more better because most of us are bystanders in a sense to most things. We're not involved in everything that happens in the world. But I also pointed out that where we tend to point fingers at and accuse people then of all sorts of terrible things, the banks and the insurance companies and the neutral powers and the allied powers and the Vatican and so on, why didn't you and this and that and the other, that means that we must be better. Who are we to point fingers? Are we? And then I raised the subject of anti-Semitism, which we thought was perhaps not cured from the world, but at least tamped down and put a lid on it, because who is willing to want to come out and publicly say I'm an anti-Semite after the Holocaust? And that was true. There weren't that many who would come out publicly as anti-Semites after the Holocaust. Well, Stalin, but not that many would. But now in the last, we're very much aware of things in the last couple of years, but really there's been a growing upswell of anti-Semitic activity for the last generation. And it's gone from vandalism and some violence in the street to actual attempted murder and mass murder, the synagogues and all that. And I think that is a call for our contemporary civilization to take a good long look in the mirror and try to figure out what's going on and try to resolve that. So these are the issues that I was raising, and a lot more to say.
Well, related to that is the fairly recent rise in right-wing populism in Western countries, and not only anti-Semitism, but racism, xenophobia, in general, otherism, this kind of, I don't know, prejudice or attacks on people who are different. And anti-Semitism, you're right. I mean, anti-Semitism is something that's considered a no-no. People shouldn't speak about that. But then nowadays it's Islamophobia, or in the United States, people coming from Latin America and trying to immigrate to the United States, and people trying to come to Europe as refugees from all these wars that are going on in the Middle East, or for economic reasons from Africa. It's happening all over, and there's this kind of anti-otherism. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Well, I wouldn't be someone to say history is repeating itself, because that's not possible. But are there some similarities to things that happened, say, 100 years ago? There are some similarities in the illiberalism and intolerance and xenophobia, in the insular nationalism. Nationalism isn't a bad word. I mean, we all have a national identity that involves culture and language and history. And that can be something that a people has out of a sense of this is who we are, and we respect who you are, and it's interesting who you are, it's interesting who we are, and you get along. That's possible and exists in the world. But in the ultra-nationalism that includes the xenophobia and the insularity, and the people who are outside are not good, and people who try to be more open or somehow undermining the well-being of our nation and so on, That's a step in a dangerous direction. Where could it end up? I have no idea. I won't say that where we are now, certainly wouldn't say that where we are now is pointing to we might get to another event like the Holocaust or something like that. It's a long way to go until any of us could say something like that. But as it is right now, this immense intolerance and growing disinterest or disaffection from democracy, and the ideas that liberal humanism, which is at the basis of democracy, gave us about mutual tolerance and breaking down barriers between peoples. I mean, when I was a kid, we studied other cultures in school, not because we all wanted to go. I remember we studied South America, Peru in particular. when I was in sixth grade. And we didn't do that because all of us were going to go out to Machu Picchu all of a sudden and become Incas. We did that because it was interesting and broke down barriers between who we are, where we sat, and who they are. And it's interesting. Wow, let's learn interesting cultures about each other. And that's supposed to promote mutual tolerance, and that's falling by the wayside in many countries. And that's a dangerous recipe for the future, because when you have that, ultimately you could have everyone against everyone instead of everyone together for the good of all.
Do you think that the Holocaust in some way had such a big impact because it occurred in a European country and it was also carried out in a very programmed, organized way? Nobody really talks about Armenia or Rwanda, and to some extent, I think that there's almost a racist undertone there. I mean, what happened in Rwanda? It's Africa. You know, they're uncivilized. But, you know, Germany was civilized. You know what I mean? And that people might minimize the importance of some other genocides because of this, because we weren't the ones who committed this.
Well, I think you've got a very good point there. And first of all, when you're saying that, I think you're relating to general society. In the academic world and among educators who study the things that academics wrote and translate that into education in their classrooms, they certainly are aware of the Armenians and Rwanda and Cambodia, et cetera, all these, you know, horrible things that have gone on. None of them is the Holocaust, but it shouldn't be. We shouldn't be waiting around for a Holocaust to happen to say, oh, now it's important. It's important even if it's not a Holocaust. But for those people, the scholars and all the educators, I think that they are aware. For the general public, I think you've got a very good point, and for the politicians and the leaders of many countries, that Germany is so much like us, the Western world. It's the Western world that's looking at this, right? The Western Europeans, the Central Europeans, the North Americans, the Australians, right? They're looking at this saying, these are people just like us. They're highly educated, and there's universal literacy. The first country that established that was Germany in the 19th century with mandatory public education so that everybody can read and write, because it's a fundamental tool for a person to succeed in society. And here this most advanced and cultural and philosophical society did that. And that's shocking. They're part of us, and look what they did. And there, I would argue that there is a racist element there, particularly regarding Africa. It's not just Rwanda, I mean, and Darfur and also the Middle East. I mean, you know, there are many reasons why countries don't want to get involved in Syria and Iraq, for example. Many reasons. It's a mess there. You know, who's fighting whom, and on what side do you partner with, and all that. Very complicated. But enough years have gone by that, you know, the leaders of governments might have figured out, okay, here's a plan, let's try a plan. But there hasn't been a plan. You know, the only one who really intervened is Putin, and now Erdogan, and they're not doing it out of their great concern for humanity. So I would say that there is an element of racism there, but that's not all there is to it. I think that part of the reason the Holocaust, the fundamental reason we talk so much about the Holocaust, is because it went so far beyond every other attempted genocide or actual genocide that we know of. It was a rupture in our history. Because the Holocaust was the only case where, as you pointed out, there was the most extreme case of bringing modern technology to bear. In Rwanda, it's all machetes and rifles. And in the Holocaust, it's part rifles and machine guns and starvation and beatings. But half the Jews who were killed in various forms of gassing. And it was very much organized, using modern train systems and modern train schedules to plug in trains that will transport Jews, the way you might plug in a train for chartering a special vacation for the factory, they plug in the Jews. And using them, for all that, they're using modern technology. But the Holocaust was a seek and destroy mission that aimed to wipe out every single Jew without exception. There was no concept of conversion, of this one's okay, but the other one is not okay, of just send them all away so we don't have to look at them anymore. That wasn't it, and they were trying to wipe out every person and every element of Jewish culture that they could identify, just wipe it off the face of the earth. And that magnitude of things also is important. And we can't escape the fact that the Holocaust happened in a world that was already into modern communications. in a country and in a part of the world that had lots of modern communications, modern for those days. So there are photographs and there are film clips and people were writing letters, diaries, reports, and all this survived and people were aware of what was going on in real time. With the Armenians, that was less the case, somewhat, but less the case. Earlier cases, the Herero and the Namo in that most people don't even know about in Southwest Africa, what's today Namibia, that the Germans murdered by the tens of thousands in the early 20th century. Modern communications there. Yeah. So I think that all those factors together played a role, and I would say that the racism is an element.
Is there anything else that you would like to add that we might have left out as a conclusion?
One of the points I was raising in the talk and that I keep raising in classrooms, I work at Yad Vashem, but I also teach in two different universities, alternate semesters. And you know, I raise, why are we studying this subject? It's shattering. It shatters our image of our own society, so we have to work on rebuilding it all. But at the bottom line, we study it collectively, all of us, whoever studies it around the world, in order to understand it enough so that we can have a hope collectively of understanding enough in order to put some kind of breaks in education or whatever we need in place so that we can prevent such things from happening again. Because it's clear that once the Holocaust happened, the Nazis and their partners set a precedent. They introduced something new into this world, that totality of murder of every member of the group everywhere and anywhere in the world. They introduced something new into this world. And once they introduce that thing into this world, now it's possible. And the next person can come along, the next group, doesn't have to be Germans and Jews, could be anybody and anybody, and try to do it better. You know, here are the Nazis' mistakes, I won't make the same mistakes. And with more modern technology, they might even do it faster, more efficiently. And it's an urgent task for us to try to figure all this out so that we can prevent such things from happening in the future. That's our task.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.